This is a CNA podcast.
Are you and your friends and family sticking to WhatsApp after its new terms and conditions?
Yes, we are. Simply because, you know, it's a platform that we know and we've been using all this while. And moving to another place and forcing all your friends and family to come over is just not going to happen.
For me, it's a yes, because we feel like we have nothing to hide on these chats. I think the other thing is that we've been using it for a long time. I think we are all creatures of habit.
You might have seen a message pop up on your WhatsApp account this week asking you to sign off on a new set of terms and conditions to share information with Facebook. And if you try to swipe that notification away, you'll quickly realize you can't ignore it. It's a take it or leave it. Click yes, accepting these conditions, and you can continue using WhatsApp. Click no, and you might have to cease using the app sometime soon. These probably explain the spike in downloads this week for Telegram and Signal, two other instant messaging apps. Now, we've asked our Facebook followers whether they were doing likewise, and some of you had interesting comments, which I'll circle back later on in this show. But first, what's behind WhatsApp's latest data grab? And how different is it from past changes to its terms and conditions? And can we finally have that awkward conversation about what we need to do with Facebook and its platforms? I'm Lin Su Ling, and this is Heart of the Matter. It's Thursday, January 14. With me are Natalie Pang, Senior Lecturer at the NUS Department of Communications and New Media.
Hi, everyone.
And Rajesh Srinivasan, Head of Technology, Media and Telecommunications at Raja & Tann.
Hello, everyone.
Hi, guys. Maybe just to get us started, when you saw the terms and conditions, did you both read it through?
Yes.
Oh, you did?
As a lawyer, it's my job, so.
Yeah, I guess because you're a lawyer. I must say I didn't when I first saw it, but because I do research in this area, I had to spend some time to unpack exactly what these new terms of and conditions actually mean.
Right. There's been some confusion because there was quite a bit to pour through, but could you help break down what the changes are exactly?
Sure. A few key notes first. The changes does not affect the way in which people communicate with one another. As far as your personal messages are concerned, there's no change to the encryption obligations that WhatsApp has already put in place for such messaging. And this is a very real thing, meaning that even when it comes to law enforcement officers asking for access to such messages, WhatsApp's position remains unchanged, which is that we don't have access to it ourselves. So that hasn't changed. And so a lot of concern out there that, oh, no, you know, they're going to be reading my messages, or, you know, wives saying that husbands who may have issues will have advertisements pop up about divorce lawyers, etc. I've just got so many of these memes on my phone. That simply is not true.
Yeah. So what are the changes, Natalie, now that you've thought through them?
Yeah, I must admit, it took me some time. Actually, before I talk about the changes, I want to add on to the earlier point that actually there are still some things that have not changed. Facebook would not be able to look at the messages, the chats that people have on their WhatsApp. And the other thing I'd like to add is that Facebook already has some data. For instance, what are the phone numbers using WhatsApp, how often they use WhatsApp, and the approximate location. In a way, people are already sharing data with WhatsApp. What has changed is that with the new terms and conditions, it will allow for, I guess, a greater possibility of end users mingling or interacting directly with businesses, having some kinds of commercial transactions happening via WhatsApp as well.
Well, we asked our Facebook followers their views about this latest move by WhatsApp. And in all, nothing at all, cynicism seemed to arise from the comments. Number one, Jeffrey Say mentioned, no matter how many platforms you use, the thing is, privacy will always be there. As long as you have a smartphone, your privacy is already compromised. JX Lee mentioned, if you're in the digital world, why bother with privacy? Why do people think that they can have that privacy? Why are people feeling that way? What's behind this sudden angry reaction if the changes indeed are so small?
It's an overarching concern. People feel when they use social media, when they're on the internet, that somehow their movements are being tracked. A lot of that happens because of new technologies that allow companies to provide customized and personalized information. And because of that, people confuse that perhaps with the fact that every platform, therefore, is always collecting their data, sharing that data. So it is a natural concern. I don't think, you know, it's wrong for people to be concerned about their privacy. In fact, everyone should be concerned about their privacy. None of those issues change. But the reality is that before we go out there and try and persecute the next organization that appears to be transparent in terms of its data use, take a step back and ask, would it be better to know what your data is being used for than not to know? And these organizations trying to be transparent should not be punished in a sense for wanting to be transparent about the way in which data is used. My concern here is that because of what's happening to Facebook, the other organizations may now think twice before being as transparent as Facebook has been about the way in which the data is intended to be used.
But Facebook, in acquiring WhatsApp in 2014, had actually assured the US Federal Trade Commission, which approves these mergers and acquisitions, that it would not tap on WhatsApp's data. How do you square that off with this latest development?
You have to look at what happened then with what's going on today. The approach that Facebook has taken with the latest round of changes is still one of informing the people that the data is going to be used for such purposes. The data will be used with the person's consent, which is the reason why people have to sort of accept. And if you choose not to accept, what happens then is that you have a situation where you will not be able to do business or communicate with businesses over the WhatsApp platform the way you should optimally be able to with such consent. The fact that people are concerned about it now is a bit surprising also, simply because the data sharing is not a new thing. It has been going on for a bit. And as far as the FTC disclosures were concerned, those were with regard to things such as the messages that people share online. And I say again, Facebook has not backtracked from end-to-end encryption with regard to messaging. So we need to look specifically at what kind of data we're talking about in terms of being shared, map that back to what has originally been shared and ask, what's the change? And that's when you realize there is no change.
Just want to put a pin in that and bring in Natalie, your take about the fact that people are outraged because they've been used to social media and the internet, sharing their data, taking their data and whatnot. Natalie, get your view. It's not a two-way street. Mm. All of us and a lot of folks who are on the internet have been willingly participating in social media, actively giving out our data. Facebook asks for your phone number. Some of us might have backed away, but a lot of us said, yes, I'll give you my phone number happily. So what's so different about this? Why are we so outraged when it seems like this is a line that has been crossed a long time ago that was suddenly outraged about?
Thanks for sharing the comments from your listeners. In the case of Singapore in particular, there has been actually a number of inflection points for people that are directly or not directly connected to Facebook. One of it was Cambridge Analytica, if we all remember. It involved Facebook actually allowing this company to use the data of their users, and millions of accounts were involved in that whole scandal in which targeted advertisements were actually sent to them. For many people, that was one major inflection point that social media company like Facebook can make use of our browser data, who our friends are, what we click on, what we like, and what kinds of comments we leave, for instance, and use them for commercial means. That has been one inflection point. And in recent years, there has also been a number of data breaches. So people have this heightened awareness. And
what do you mean by concern, other companies and yes, other organizations?
Yes, including SingHealth, right? People do have this heightened awareness and consciousness that so long as there's some kind of recording or capture of our data, even with privacy actually policies in place, we can't actually keep them entirely safe from malicious actors like hackers.
But these updates should not come as a surprise, because as you pointed out, in 2016, users had that opt-in to be able to provide Facebook with their data, and that would give them, you know, better French suggestions, better ads even. So what's wrong with that? What's wrong with the latest update?
It's a great question. And, you know, that's why we need to take a step back. It is a pent-up concern and frustration that people have. You know, to your point, I totally agree with that. People need outlets. And sometimes, you know, the social media platforms that you use most are the ones that you suspect the most, simply because that's the one where you spend so much time on and where you see these inflection points actually materialize in terms of personalized ads, etc. The reality, though, is that data collection happens everywhere. The concern I have is that, you know, a lot of organizations perhaps may be looking at just plain consent and saying, look, I have the permission of the users to use the data for these purposes. The reality is that informed consent? Do people really read the terms and conditions? To your earlier point, how many people
actually understand it, right?
Yeah, that's the reality. And even if companies do take the pains to make it that simple, how many people actually take 1 minute off their time, very busy time, to actually read those terms and conditions? People still skip it, and they just skip take accept because they want to go in, they want to read the news, etc. And that's the nub of it. And you'll notice that in Singapore, for example, the amendments to the Personal Data Protection Act have started us down this road of moving away from just looking at consent and overly relying on consent, but move more towards principles like legitimate interest. That means looking at the way in which organizations use that data and organizations themselves, the data custodians, asking themselves, can I stand by this particular use case for this data? Is it in the interest of my customers for the data to be used in this manner, in addition to getting consent? That would be the correct and responsible and accountable way of using data.
Now that you've brought up laws, I think I want to jump right into that. These messages about the new terms and conditions didn't appear in Europe, ostensibly because of the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, where European users can't be forced to share personal data with Facebook under those EU regulations. Why don't these same protections apply to us under the PDPA, as you've rightly brought up?
The GDPR sets the gold standard, as many people say, in data protection internationally, and intends to actually be extraterritorial in terms of the application of the GDPR. All that said, Singapore's approach, as many other developed countries, is to try and take a balanced approach between the cost of the need to protect individuals' privacy and ensuring that responsible businesses are still allowed to use the data in a responsible manner. And that's the reason why principles like legitimate interest, as I mentioned before, really is what we should be looking at. Meaning that don't allow organizations to just simply collect consent, uninformed consent from people, and say, look, I have your consent. The one lesson that many organizations have learned when people get upset about the data is it's no use for you to take the terms and conditions and put that in front of the person and say, but you said we can do this. It just doesn't resonate with the users because clearly they had not read those terms and conditions. So rather than shifting the burden to the end users, who clearly are not in a position to give informed consent, shift the burden back to the data custodians, so people who have collected the data, to be able to prove and demonstrate, if challenged, that the data is used in a manner which is in the interest of the individuals. And if the answer is no, then sit back, ask yourself, is this correct or incorrect? That's really key here. So you get consent, right? And that's still necessary. But take a step back and ask yourself as an organization, will I be able to defend this use of data? And that's when you'll do certain things like doing extra rounds of notifications. What Facebook has done here, for example, WhatsApp and more specifically has done here, is taken that extra step of bringing these changes to the attention of the users. If you ask me strictly, did WhatsApp have to do this? The interesting answer may actually be, well, if you look at the terms and conditions, it already says that the users have in fact said that they agree to certain use of personal data. Strictly speaking, they may even have chosen not to do this. They chose to be transparent. They chose to inform users, look, this is going to be happening. We're going to be sharing this data with businesses for business messaging purposes. And then all hell broke loose. The lessons to be learned from this, when we take a step back and think about it, are two things. One, organizations should not be deterred from this exercise, from still continuing to be transparent to their users. And two, organizations should not rely blindly on consent alone, but take extra steps to notify, to educate, to inform, and themselves look at the use of data and ask, is this justifiable? Is it reasonable? When you look at the purpose for which the data was originally collected, then go ahead and use the data.
Nestle, I see you nodding along.
I want to jump in on that point about informed consent. I fully agree with the comment that the burden has been on consumers and end users to take that step, to go read the term consent conditions before they agree. But quite often, I think for many users, they feel like they have no choice because all their friends are on WhatsApp. It's essential for them to, for instance, continue using the platform in order to stay in touch with the people they care about and also do businesses if they need to. Informed consent is one thing. It's also the other principle I personally like to advocate is also this principle of do no harm as well. So going back to the data custodians and getting them to see how they can actually responsibly use the data of their users is really quite important to me, especially for people in vulnerable groups, right? For instance, older folks who may not even read English and understand the terms and conditions. Even if they give their consent, it may not mean anything to them. This is obviously a gap that needs to be addressed.
So many people have pointed to the fact that when you're not paying for a product, you are the product. And in Facebook's and I guess WhatsApp's case also, we're not paying for it, even though WhatsApp did try to charge a $1 annual fee previously. Mm-hmm. If that was an option, if people could pay so that their data wouldn't be taken, do you think that would be a viable option to explore for Facebook and WhatsApp?
It's starting to happen to some extent in the business space, certainly. For individuals, though, it's a question of once you've given people something for free and then to charge for it, it's just commercially a non-viable position. And it will then lead to perhaps even a greater erosion in terms of people going to what they consider to be free sites just to save that $1 or $2. To us, you know, generally, you might say, oh, that's such a small amount, but every dollar adds up. Every dollar counts to individuals. And so, you know, if you can get a similar type of service for free, they probably would use those. And then my concern would become, how can we trust these new players that come onto the block? I would rather trust a public listed company that has got obligations and has got shareholders and accountability and is regulated by the regulators in a very severe way than a new startup that's come out onto the block and promises everything under the sun. Because one, the people who have started the startup may do so with very good intentions, wanting to be open source, wanting to protect data. But when it comes to monetization and sustainability of the platform, that's when the sad reality will hit in. And these small companies may likely get acquired by larger organizations who will not be beholden by those same principles. So choose wisely.
So Natalie, weigh in here for us. Some people say this is a long time in coming, that users should have struck a better balance in terms of efficiency, just having one or two main platforms versus resilience when you diversify and have more platforms. Do you think that was the case?
Definitely, what we are seeing here now is that the fact that there are alternatives means that users actually do see that potential. Alternative platforms like Signal and Telegram, having this number of downloads, especially in the last week or so, is evident that people do see value in that kind of diversity. But I want to go back to the point about monetizing and business model as well. Going back to your earlier question, about whether this was surprising. In many ways, for me, it was not surprising that WhatsApp took this step. If we look at the business model of Facebook, there's this free service that's offered to end users. And then secondly, businesses also get to sign up for an account. And thirdly, how Facebook really makes money is through advertising, by actually allowing businesses to sell targeted advertisements to the users that they want to reach. WhatsApp has not been able to follow this business model. So what we are seeing here in terms of changes is really about how Facebook is trying to monetize from WhatsApp at this point in time. At the moment, the fact that users are reacting so strongly is evident that they have been using this free service for some time. And the fact that there's this move to try and monetize is not actually taken very well by many users.
So the two main platforms that people are looking at is, of course, Signal because of Elon Musk's Twitter, use Signal, right? And Telegram, which some people have been on for a while now. How do these stack up against WhatsApp in both of your opinions?
From a functionality standpoint, they appear to be similar. The reality, though, is that people still go to where their brothers and sisters are, their friends, family are. The incumbents will inevitably have a strong position. With the current move towards the new platforms, the question is, how sustainable is that going to be? If it's going to be one new cycle, then by the end of this new cycle, the next new cycle comes in, someone else complains about another vendor, it stops and people will still be on WhatsApp primarily. And then perhaps, you know, would also have installed two or three other applications on their platforms. Your decision to move from one platform to the other should not be dictated just by knee-jerk reactions. Do take some time to understand what exactly has happened and then make that move. Because to move from an established platform to a new player has inherent risks, as I mentioned before, in terms of not knowing who these players are, how sustainable their business models are going to be, and whether they themselves will change their terms and conditions, perhaps to an even more severe position later on when they have themselves to make money. These are realities of life. So think carefully, don't react too quickly before making a decision on jumping platforms. Having said that, choice is always good. Do keep those platforms as well, try them out, and then make a decision based on functionality, ease of use, and where your friends are.
I think I have two points to make about the alternative platforms. One of it is that between the two, Signal actually has a more articulated policy about what they do with the data. The other thing is about the behavioral aspect of using instant messaging platforms like WhatsApp and Telegram and Signal. The fact is that people use instant messaging platforms like that, not just to share information. It is actually about connecting with people. So I'm not saying they don't share information at all. They do. For many people, there is comfort in going to a group to find support for their cause, to find people that they can rant about today's activities or talk about politics sometimes. So there is that, I guess, incumbency effect, like what was earlier mentioned. I think the likelihood of what's going to happen in the next few months, the likelihood of Telegram or Signal eventually becoming dominant market players will really depend on how many people actually port over and how successful they find replacements for their communities on instant messaging platforms.
Well, how much of the concern do you guys think was because of the sheer size of Facebook and its platforms? That's inevitable. So no matter which platform rises to the fore, there will be such concerns. I ask because over the last week, even though there was some support for Twitter and Facebook shutting down Donald Trump's account after the US Capitol storming, there were voices that came out afterwards. Angela Merkel, for example, asking if Facebook really should have that sort of power.
Platforms like Facebook and Twitter, YouTube definitely has the right to say who should or should not be on their platforms. This is actually not something new. They have been doing that since day one they started. All platforms, they have a right to ban users or shut down accounts. What people are uncomfortable with is how much weight these tech platforms have in terms of shaping public discourse. Bearing in mind that a lot of public discourse right now, they are happening online. Online platforms are also being used to mobilize people towards certain causes. The discomfort right now is that these platforms actually has so much say in terms of what gets circulated in the public discourse.
Looking at it from a legal standpoint, in Singapore's context at least, the decision-making process is one that the government has taken a hands-on approach on in terms of putting in place laws that govern content regulation, as well as laws such as POFMA, under which they have the ability to require takedown notices, correction notices, etc., to be done by organizations, including social media. I'm not one to advocate that this necessarily is a solution for all jurisdictions. But when you take a step back and you look at the social media organizations, they can't not do anything. It is, at the end of the day, a private company, and it is their platform. And so they do have some degree of choice as to what they choose to use the platform for and who they allow these platforms be used by. Most of them, including Facebook, have community standards that they've set up also. And these are transparent community standards. And they include obvious things like not to incite violence. So in this particular instance, whether you agree or not as to the substance of Donald Trump's speech and whether it did in fact incite violence, there is an objective basis for them to say that there is a clear example of their community standards being breached. And so on that basis, they've chosen to exercise their right. So it's not something that's completely arbitrary. There are standards that every organization is allowed to set. The concern people have is, will these community standards match with societal standards from country to country? Because, you know, a private company will often make these community standards decisions based perhaps on where their home country is. And those standards may not be a global standard. The ultimate answer is a combination of community standards and some degree of policing at a societal level, whether that be by way of law or pressure groups or lobbies within countries, making clear their citizens' positions. And then the social media companies can take a balanced approach.
So just to round off this podcast, right, my last question really is, given all we've discussed today of the implications and the great power that WhatsApp and Facebook wields legitimately as huge companies, antitrust has often been brought up in that conversation. And with the Joe Biden administration and the Democrat Congress, what do you think are the prospects on that regarding Facebook's case there?
Been following competition law in the tech space for many, many years. I'm not an advocate of breaking companies up. Whether you go all the way back to the baby bells, you know, when the original telcos are broken up, it's never quite worked. Either there's consolidation and then you're back to status quo, after which there's a lot of wasted opportunity and a lot of innovation, etc., and new ways of services that could have been rendered to users delayed for a period of time. I've not seen those actions really serve its purpose. So I'm not a big fan of that. I think it's more a question of policing, joint policing by all parties concerned about the nature of what kind of content you want and do not want to have on these platforms, and for societies to stand up and make their voices heard as loudly as they can so that these social media companies will also have to take that into account as part of their community standards.
Right, and I guess as part of that also because people can migrate to Signal or Telegram, that's another alternative. Yes. What about you, Natalie, rounding parting shots for our listeners?
From the end user's point of view, I do think that people can be uncomfortable with one tech company owning so much power in the way their interactions are governed, in a sense of actually them shaping public discourse. For many people, there's certainly some kind of discomfort there. Whether it may be addressed through antitrust, I think that remains to be seen. People do want more diversity in terms of alternative platforms they can go to.
So there you have it. Perhaps we may use this opportunity to text less and pick up the phone and talk more, maybe. This has been Heart of the Matter. This podcast was recorded with Sennheiser. You can find previous episodes on the CNA website, app, Me Listen, Apple, and Spotify. The team behind this episode is Crispina Robert and Erin Lowe. And I'm Lin Suling, signing off until we meet again next week.